He attacked a rack of ribs. And the spot you picked to rendezvous with him isn't where one of the transceivers is stashed? She asked. Nah, said George, dabbing at his sauce-soaked beard with a napkin. We'll rendezvous in dead empty space. I gave him the coordinates. If anybody's following us, we'll both be able to see him long before they can cause any trouble. Pancho nodded. And you send all your messages to Lars over a tight laser link?
Yep.
Just about impossible for anybody to intercept him or eavesdrop. If somebody does get into the beam, we see it right away as a drop in received power.
Pretty cute.
Pretty necessary, George said, picking up another sauce-dripping barbecued rib.
In the weeks since his encounter with a disguised logistics ship, Roebuck, Lars Fuchs had added a new wrinkle to his Nautilus. Ships operating in deep space required radiation shielding. When solar flares erupted and spewed planet-engulfing clouds of deadly ionizing particles through interplanetary space, a ship without shielding was little more than a coffin for its crew. The powerful protons in such clouds were particularly dangerous, capable of killing humans and frying electronic systems within minutes, unless they were properly protected. Most spacecraft shielded themselves by charging their outer skins to a very high positive electrical potential. This diverted the deadly high-energy protons of the radiation cloud. The cloud also contained electrons, however, which were less energetic but capable of discharging the ship's positive electrical field. To keep the electrons at bay, the ships surrounded themselves with a magnetic field generated by lightweight superconducting wires. Thus, spacecraft operating beyond the Earth-Moon system were wrapped in an invisible but powerful magnetic field of their own and charged their outer skins to high positive potential when a solar storm broke out. Fuchs, once a planetary geochemist, used Nautilus's electron guns to charge up his craft's skin, then covered the spacecraft with pebbles and dust from a loosely aggregated chondritic asteroid. A radar probe of his spacecraft gave a return that looked like the pebbly surface of a small beanbag type of chondritic asteroid. Moreover, the dust and pebbles would scatter a laser beam and absorb its energy even better than the copper shields he had affixed earlier to Nautilus's hull. If he let his ship drift in a sun-centered orbit, Fuchs felt confident that Nautilus would look to a casual probe just like a small dumbbell-shaped asteroid. He felt less confident, though, about responding to Big George's latest message. Pancho wants to meet me face to face, he mused. Why? What's so important that she's coming out here into the belt to find me? I don't like it, he muttered to himself. Sanja, on duty in the pilot's chair, the son of a former Mongol tribesman, turned his shaved head toward Fuchs and asked, Sir? Nothing, Sanja, said Fuchs. Nothing. Once you've reached orbital velocity, cut power, and let the ship coast.
Matilda 2. We have arrived at the designated position, said the pilot. Pancho was sitting in the co-pilot's chair of Matilda 2's snug, efficiently laid-out bridge. The pilot, seated on her left, was a youngster she had met when she'd come aboard for this flight. He looked like a kid to Pancho, blonde and soft-cheeked and scrubbed pink, but he ran the vessel well enough. Good square shoulders, she noticed. Pancho's piloting skills were rusty, she knew, but inwardly she longed for a chance to fly this bucket just for a little larking around. She couldn't ask, of course. The chairman of the board of Astro Corporation isn't supposed to be a fly girl. One of the epithets that Humphreys often threw at her was grease monkey. Pancho had no intention of giving the humper any ammunition. Still, she thought, as she watched the young man play his fingers over the control panel's keyboard, it'd be fun to goose up the engines and see what this flying machine can do. This is the spot, isn't it? George asked. Standing behind the pilot's seat, he bent forward slightly to peer out the forward window. Nothing visible except the desert of dark, empty space, bangled with solemn, unblinking stars. The pilot's name was Oscar Johansson. Despite his youthful appearance, he was stiffly formal with George and Pancho. "Yes, sir," he said, pointing to the control panel's main display screen. "These are the coordinates in yellow, and this is our position, the blinking red cursor. As you can see, sir, they overlap. We are at the proper position." George nodded. Pancho admired Johansson's strong jaw and gleaming white teeth. Wish he'd smile, she thought. I wonder what it'd take to ruffle his composure a bit. No ships in sight? Nothing in view, sir, except a small asteroid, about 500 clicks off, in about the 4 o'clock position. He tapped the keyboard once. 517 kilometers, 122 degrees relative to our position, 8 degrees elevation. Pancho grinned at the kid's earnestness. I thought this position was clear of rocks for at least 1,000 clicks all around, she said. George scratched at his beard, answering. Rocks get kicked into new orbits all the time, Pancho. Gravity resonances from Jupiter. The other planets are always scrabbling the smaller chunks. Resisting the urge to run the display herself, she said, an unnumbered rock. Might as well claim it. To do that, one of us would have to suit up and go out there and plant a marker on it. Why not? Pancho said, pushing herself up from her seat. I'll do it. Claim it for Astro. Gimme a closer look at it, Oscar, George said. The radar image showed a dumbbell-shaped chondritic asteroid slowly tumbling end over end. A peanut, George said. Just like what's his name? Ida, said Johansson. Asteroid number 243. Showing off your college education, Aussie? Asked George. Johansson actually blushed. Pushing past George, Pancho said, I'll go out and claim it. Give me something to do while we're waiting for Lars to show up. George turned and ducked through the hatch after her. I'll give you a hand, Pancho. I can do it myself, she said, heading up the narrow passageway toward the main airlock where the spacesuits were stored. You'll need help getting into a suit, George called after her. I'll have to suit up myself too, you know. You don't have to. Safety regs, George said firmly. Somebody's got to be suited up and ready to go out in case of an emergency. Pancho humphed, but didn't object. Safety regulations had saved more than one astronaut's butt, she knew. She allowed George to help her into the suit and check out her seals and systems. Then she helped George and checked him out. What's funny? George asked as he pulled the fishbowl helmet over his wild red mane. Pancho hadn't realized she was grinning. George seemed about to burst his suit seams. Georgie, you look like a red-headed Santa Claus, you know that? Ho, he answered flatly. Pancho was ready to step into the airlock when Johansson's voice came over the ship's intercom. A ship's approaching, he called out. It's coming up fast.
Lasers armed and ready, sir, said the weapons technician. Harbin nodded curtly, his eyes focused on the image of Matilda II on the main screen of Samarkand's bridge. Nothing else in range except a minor asteroid some 500 clicks away. Samarkand carried two powerful continuous-wave lasers, adapted from the cutting tools the rock rats used, plus a high-energy pulsed weapon capable of blowing a centimeter-sized hole in the metal skin of a spacecraft from a distance of 1,000 kilometers. Matilda's crew module was out of position, Harbin saw. It had rotated away from his fast-approaching ship and was partially shielded by the bulk of the propulsion system, engines, and big spherical fuel tanks. Stand by, Harbin ordered quietly. The three crew personnel on the bridge with him sat tensely, waiting for the order to fire. Just a little closer, Harbin said under his breath to the slowly rotating Matilda. Just turn a little bit more. There. The crew module was clearly visible. Fire, Harbin said to the weapons tech. To make certain, he pressed the red button on the keypad set into his command chair's armrest. We got her, he whispered triumphantly.